Nearly a quarter century into the HIV/AIDS pandemic, there are still a number of unresolved ethical questions surrounding the virus, among them whether gay men should be banned from donating blood and the state laws that criminalize the transmission of HIV. These issues are further complicated by the fact that there are over 1 million people in the United States who are HIV positive. Roughly a third don't know it. We continue our five-part series, AIDS Then and Now, with a look at the ethical issues of HIV/AIDS. Our guest is Dr. Robert Klitzman, the director of the Ethics and Policy Corps of the HIV Center at Columbia University. He's the author of numerous books, including Mortal Secrets, Truth and Lies in the Age of AIDS, and I'm very pleased to welcome him back to our show today.
Thank you.
Earlier this month, the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services voted to uphold the ban on blood donations from men who've had sex with other men in the years since 1977. Were you at all surprised by that ruling?
I was not, sadly. I think that the ban is unfortunate in a number of ways. I think it doesn't make sense in a lot of ways. We now have good testing for HIV. We could have people donate and be tested and then tested again at some point to make sure that they're still negative if they test negative. And I think in many ways it reflects public fear and hysteria which underlies a lot of the discrimination and stigma, which unfortunately continues around this disease.
Well, the ban was put in place in the 1980s, and things have changed a lot, but I guess not this. Does the ban apply to other high-risk groups, people who inject drugs legally or illegally?
There are questions. Where do you draw the line? And, of course, you're also relying on self-report. So someone may have injected drugs at some point and may not say that. Someone may have had sex with a member of the same gender, or they may have had sex with their husband or wife and now have HIV and not know it and yet be able to give blood. So in many ways, the ruling is somewhat inconsistent in that, especially as you mentioned, one-third of the people in this country who have HIV do not know it. And they, many of whom are heterosexual, half of whom are heterosexual, may go ahead and give blood.
On its website, the FDA lays out an exhaustive list of reasons for why the ban on gay men donating blood should stay in place, including this one. I'm quoting, "Men who have had sex with men since 1977 have an HIV prevalence 60 times higher than the general population." If we know that to be the case, what's so unreasonable about limiting blood donations from that population?
As I said, I think there is a tension between how do we protect the public health and how do we make sure that there is enough blood. In some areas, there is not enough blood. How do we make sure that people's civil liberties aren't being violated? How do we make sure that there is as little discrimination and stigma as possible? So I think there are ways around this, which would be, for instance, repeat testing, that would accomplish these goals.
William Salatin, a columnist for Slate.com, takes the FDA argument into reductio ad absurdum. He argues this morning that if we're going to ban men who have sex with men from donating blood, why not prohibit African Americans, who are another population at higher risk? Of course, he was pointing out that there was something discriminatory about picking on one group rather than another.
Yes. And as I mentioned, half of the people in the United States who have HIV are not gay men. They are straight. About a third of those have used injecting drugs, but two-thirds haven't. So there are literally hundreds of thousands of people who are never used drugs and never had sex with a member of the same sex.
Are hemophiliacs no longer at risk? Have we fixed that problem up at all?
Pretty much, yes.
And people who get blood transfusions?
Yes. So hemophilia, originally before there was an HIV test, we would not know if the blood we were giving a hemophiliac who needs a lot of blood, if that blood was infected. And now with the HIV test, we can, of course, make sure that they get uninfected blood.
And HIV tests are becoming more and more sensitive, aren't they? There was a report just last week about a new test developed at UC San Diego that looks for HIV's genetic material as well as HIV antibodies, meaning that the window period between when a person is infected and when that infection shows on a test can be significantly narrowed.
Yes, and that's an important point because we know that people are most infectious right when they get infected. So if I get infected tomorrow, The next few weeks are when I am most infectious to someone else, and then the virus goes into cells and is less transmittable to other people.
We had a five-part series on all of these issues in 1987, and we spoke to a panel of guests about the unique ethical issues of HIV/AIDS then. One of our guests was AIDS activist Larry Kramer. He was opposed to mandatory HIV testing, which was one of the political hot potatoes of the time. Let's take a listen to his response about requiring HIV screening.
I think everybody in this country should act as if he is tested positive for the virus and behave accordingly.
Do you think that suggestion made sense in 1987? Do you think everyone should follow that advice today?
Well, I think everyone should follow Larry's advice, yes. I still think that everyone should be prepared for the fact that they may be exposed to HIV and should protect themselves, which is if you wear a condom, if you're having sex, you will not get HIV unless the condom breaks, which is rare. However, that does not, in my mind, mean that we should not also have wider testing. The fact that one-third of people don't know if they're positive and are spreading the virus, and there are 56,000 new cases of HIV per year in this country, means that we need to get people tested and into treatment.
So what would that involve? Would we, if somebody just goes to the doctor and says, I want to have a checkup, the doctor would automatically put him or her through an HIV test?
This is what is thought increasingly as important. So the CDC and Tom Frieden, when he was commissioner of health here in New York before he went to the CDC, suggested that we have routine HIV testing, which would in effect be what's called opt-out testing. So if I go to the emergency room, if I go to the doctor could just order an HIV test along with my other blood work and not have to have a special counselor sit down with me and go over all the risks and benefits and what's involved, not have a separate signed informed consent form, which is now up until now what we've had. So there has been a move, which I think makes sense for routinization of testing.
But the older system was because we were concerned about people's privacy.
Correct. The problem, again, is this is how ethically do you balance the public health of everyone versus individual civil liberties and rights. So it's one thing to – we want to protect people's civil liberties. But when there are 56,000 new people being infected with a terrible disease every year, we need to question, is there a certain point at which there's a limit to those rights, and how do we balance those? Are, of course, difficult ethical issues.
Well, in the 1980s when we did that series, routinization was of testing was controversial. Now I guess so many people have been tested, it's less so.
Well, there's also treatment available. So then if you were tested, you would just walk around with this label, I'm HIV positive. Whereas now if you're tested, you can start treatment, you can get better, you can make sure that you don't infect your partner or partners, you don't have to die, it's not a death sentence like it used to be. So those are things that we want to ensure.
Part of the problem is stigmatization. Disclosure to partners would be important if you're HIV positive. And you'd also have to talk about people you had sex with.
Yes. And these are difficult issues. As I wrote in the book you mentioned, Mortal Secrets, Truth and Lies in the Age of AIDS, they're, again, very difficult ethical issues that we each need to decide. So some people say, well, I don't tell my partners that I'm positive, but I practice safer sex. I use a condom. Well, it's a question. What if the condom breaks? Does the person have a right to know? So I think we each need to be aware of how our partners will feel about and do feel about these issues to decide what to do.
I'm talking with Dr. Robert Klitzman, who is director of the Masters of Bioethics program at Columbia University. He is talking to us today as part of our five-part series called AIDS Then and Now. This one, The Ethical Implications of HIV/AIDS. Tom Sartard of Lambda Legal was also one of our guests back in 1987, and I want to play a clip from that interview where he talks about how the government should behave towards at-risk communities.
in a public health crisis, beyond everything else, you have to have a population that trusts in and is willing to go along with the measures proposed by the government. If the government creates an inherently adversarial relationship where people don't trust the government, don't believe the information it hands out, don't want to go along with the government's proposed remedies, then the whole public health structure falls apart.
What kind of a public health message is the most effective in encouraging people to practice safe sex?
Well, we wish we knew the answer for that. Unfortunately, both here and importantly in the developing world, where there is a massive pandemic and 33 million people are infected around the world with HIV, 1 million here. But to think and to enact a effective public health campaign to get people not to practice unsafe sex has been very difficult. People say, you know, don't want to use a condom. This is the way I want to have sex. And one can argue, who is the government to come in and tell me I can't? And so we want to inspire people. One approach is through altruism, appealing to people's sense of responsibility to try to protect others. At the same time, it's important that we give the message that everyone needs to protect themselves.
I remember some years back, the Village Voice ran some articles from people who were activists promoting safe sex, and they said at times they took the risk simply for the thrill of it all.
Yes, and that's a problem, and of course drug use is a problem. So I may say there's no way I'm going to expose myself to HIV, but after a few drinks, and some people use drugs, they are unfortunately less protective of themselves, and HIV thus continues to spread that way as well. So again, I think that public health campaigns can help, partly through reminding people that HIV is still a risk, partly through promoting stronger relationships. And I think, for instance, the ban on same-sex marriage does not encourage loving close relationships and trust, which presumably would help decrease rates of HIV.
Because monogamy usually cuts down on the transmission of the disease. Do you anticipate that the health care reform bill recently passed by Congress will affect the lives of people living with HIV/AIDS dramatically?
I think it will do a lot of good, and I'm very glad that it's been passed. In particular, there have been, estimates vary, but about 40 million people in the United States who do not have health insurance. Many of those are poor people. Many of those are people of color. And we know that HIV disproportionately affects those groups.
And wasn't HIV infection enough to get you disqualified for most forms of insurance?
That's been an issue as well, exactly.
So that changes with this bill?
My understanding is yes, because you can't be excluded based on a precondition, a pre-existing condition, any pre-existing condition, HIV would fall into that. So up till now, it's possible that HIV would be considered a pre-existing condition such that an insurance company may not want to cover someone.
At what point do people with HIV qualify for things like Medicaid? When they're first diagnosed, or do they have to wait until the virus has progressed?
No, they can... Medicaid is based partly on income, and as I said, many people with HIV are unfortunately poor, and so they often are able to get Medicaid through that. And we luckily have treatment available through for those who need it, people with AIDS who have very high health costs because of the cost of medications, and luckily they've been able to be treated through programs. Yet again, there are many people who have no access to health insurance. They may say, well, health insurance is or health care is just not for me. I don't have money for that. I don't really know about these government systems. And so they may just stay away from entering into the health care system in any way. And some of those people have HIV, and they now presumably will be able to find that out and start treatment.
My guest is Dr. Robert Klitzman, who is director of the Ethics and Policy Corps of the HIV Center at Columbia University, also at Columbia, the director of the Masters of Bioethics program. He's the author of a number of books, including Mortal Secrets, Truth and Lies in the Age of AIDS. And we are talking with him in the second part of our series, Then and Now, looking at HIV/AIDS, this one on the ethical implications of the disease. Stay with us for more. Dr. Robert Klitzman of Columbia University is our guest on today's show, AIDS Then and Now, the second in the series, looking at the ethical implications of HIV/AIDS. The 1970s political establishment, from the Reagan White House to the Koch administration, were criticized for their inaction, many people felt, in response to the AIDS crisis. Dr. Carol Levine was one of the guests on our 1987 panel. Let's take a listen to another clip from that show where Dr. Levine is talking about the way politicians were responding to the epidemic back then.
It is, in the largest sense, a political problem as to how we allocate our money and where we put our resources. So they can't avoid it. I think what they're doing right now is trying to figure out where they can take a politically acceptable stand that's not going to alienate too many people. And my concern is that in the next election, that this will become a politicized rather than a political issue, and that we will see responses from the political leaders that are not based on good public health information and good solid resource allocation, but based on telling people what they want to hear.
She was talking about the 1988 election. Have things changed a lot over the last 12 years?
Yes, they have, dramatically so, and in part because of the efforts of AIDS activism, groups like ACT UP that Larry Kramer, who you played the tape of earlier, started.
Then called radicals. Yeah.
Yes. It's quite interesting, the history. They were, in many cases, brought into the drug companies by drug companies. They were sort of some activists were then hired by drug companies rather than fighting drug companies to be able to help energize what was going on and to help advocate for more money for research, which then happened. Luckily, there was treatment that was developed, the so-called cocktail, and more money for HIV prevention. So because it was effectively fought by AIDS activists, AIDS patients who felt they had nothing to lose but to fight politically, there were enormous strides made. And that actually, interestingly, has become a model for patients with other kinds of diseases to become advocates.
In the 1980s, one of the major issues we spoke about was the high cost of AZT and other AIDS drugs. Have those costs changed? Have they gone down?
Well, what's happened is there have been, as I mentioned, very good federal and state programs that cover the cost of HIV meds for people who need them. So they have now become available routinely for people because they are effective. And in the developing world, in part because of activist pressures from around the world, those medications have become available to people who really can't afford them in the developing world through the so-called PEPFAR program.
Well, how much does it cost to treat someone in the United States who's HIV positive, and how much does it cost in the developing world through PEPFAR, which is the President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief?
Yes, exactly. It's about $20,000 for the meds, what the drug companies would charge per year per person. However, as I said, there are federal programs, state programs that will cover the cost of the medications for people with HIV in this country. And interestingly, the drug companies agreed to let generic drugs be manufactured that are a fraction of the cost of what the brand name drugs are, and those are the drugs that are being made available in the developing world often.
Some of the African countries have much more enlightened programs than others. A big surprise to many was the resistance of the former South African president, Thabo Mbeki, who denied that HIV and AIDS were connected. He claimed it was some form of chronic fatigue syndrome.
Yes, it's very sad. I heard Mbeki speak when I was in South Africa at one point at the International AIDS Conference, and he said, HIV does not cause AIDS, poverty causes AIDS, which I thought was rather clever because, of course, poverty contributes, but HIV is still the cause. And it's an interesting phenomenon. There is a great deal of AIDS denialism, if you will.
Why do you think that is? In this country as well, there are some people who are still arguing that the case has not been made.
Right. A few things. In the case of sub-Saharan Africa, I remember speaking to a physician from Namibia at that conference, and he supported what Mbeki was saying. And he said, basically the reports that 20% are now 25% of 30% of some areas in South Africa, Southern Africa, are infected. And it was so alarming, so disturbing. And for instance, in South Africa, the fact that Nelson Mandela had overthrown apartheid, who was this great era of revolution, of newness, of freshness, and the fact that a third of the country, and in some years up to 40% of the young women in the country were HIV infected, was just so horrific that people could not accept that. And so the amount of stigma and discrimination and fear and hysteria that existed here was hugely amplified. I think that's one problem. What their rationalizations, what this doctor from Namibia said to me is, well, have they gone and tested every single person? And if not, how can they say that 30% of my country is infected with HIV? And of course, they had done epidemiological surveys. They hadn't gone and tested every person. But I think when things are so overwhelming to us that our anxiety would just overwhelm us, we tend to shut down and deny that there's a problem.
Haven't there also been proposals to pay people to take HIV medications in Africa because of the stigmatization?
Yes, and this is a very interesting ethical controversy as well that's involved with this, which is if people are not going to come to clinic and take the medication, it's cheaper if we pay them a few dollars or find out how much we need to pay them so that they will take it, because in the long run, every person who's on effective treatment will not be infecting other people. So if someone is not treated and they go infect five people, that's going to be five times the cost. It's cheaper to pay them. The problem is people then say, well, what about the people who are already taking their medications and aren't being paid? Is it fair to them? Shouldn't they be paid? But I think that there are studies that suggest that this may be an effective prevention tool that a lot of researchers are exploring.
Has this been tried with other medical programs?
It's been tried with medical programs that involve a one-time activity. So, for instance, getting people to be vaccinated, getting kids to be vaccinated. There are some areas where parents are very distrustful of vaccines against mumps and rubella, measles. And so there have been efforts to pay them to come have the kid get a shot. Those programs have worked well. The problem with HIV medication payments is, will the payments go on for the rest of the person's life? If we pay, someone pays me for a year to take my medication and then says, well, the money's run out, am I going to still take my medication or stop? And there's some suggestion people may not continue the medication once they've the payments stop.
As we have seen with people who take drugs for psychological problems, if they're feeling good, they don't think they need the drugs anymore.
Exactly right. And so these are major issues that we need to investigate.
My guest is Dr. Robert Klitzman of Columbia University. We're talking about AIDS then and now, an update from a series that we did in 1987. Today we're looking at the ethical implications of HIV/AIDS. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. In the time since the conversation we had in 1987, a number of states have passed laws criminalizing HIV transmission. Under what circumstances is transmission usually considered criminal in most states?
Well, states vary. Some states say that it's only if I intended to infect a partner and infected that partner, is that criminal. Other states say simply if I have HIV, if I don't tell a partner, even if that partner never becomes infected, I'm still liable, I can go to jail. Some other states say, well, if I don't tell a partner and have unsafe sex and they get infected regardless of whether I intended it or not. So states vary quite a bit, and that's unfortunate.
Something like 39 states have different laws. What kinds of penalties are common in these states that have HIV transmission laws?
Well, some states consider it a misdemeanor. Some states consider it a felony. Some states therefore have prison sentences of a dozen years. It varies also on what the circumstances are. So unfortunately, such cases or there are times when HIV transmission occurs when a woman was raped, for instance, or there was some kind of sexual assault. It seems to me that punishing the assault is really what's important, and trying to get rid of rape is what's important. But so HIV transmission or HIV exposure may be added as a prison term on top of the other term.
Well, what is your feeling about this? Are there any benefits to these laws?
Well, I think there is some potential benefit, but you have to weigh the fact that there's a trade-off, which is if you have very strict criminalization laws that apply to people who are infected who may not disclose that fact but practice safer sex and never infect a partner. That, to me, is not a reasonable person to have arrested and go to jail for this kind of law. However, I think so you have to accept, realize that these laws may decrease people from wanting to go get tested. They may increase the amount of stigma. They may be misused in various ways. I think that a law which is aimed at people who intend to infect others, if I say I'm going to go and infect you, that is anathema and that should be illegal.
Well, in New York, we had that case in 1997 of Nushon Williams, who was accused of infecting more than a dozen women with HIV. I'm not sure he was intentionally doing it, but he wasn't telling them that he was positive. Attorney General Andrew Cuomo moved earlier this year to block his release from prison. Isn't that reasonable? Wasn't he posing a major public health risk?
Yes. I think in that case, for instance, someone like that, the law makes sense or may make sense. The problem is, will it then be applied in situations where it may not make sense? So Nushon Williams, and of course his identity was immediately made public, was, as I recall, a mentally ill man who had many other problems, was homeless, etc. So there is a danger in generalizing from that to having a law which can affect other people, whether or not infection in fact occurs.
That case led to the passage of a law requiring doctors and laboratories to report to the state the names of people who test positive for HIV. Why would the state have an interest in knowing that?
Well, ideally, if we know everyone who has HIV, we can make sure that they are in treatment, that they are getting treated. And we could also, the state argues, see where are there new cases. So if we suddenly find a community and find suddenly in the past few months there's been a rise in the number of cases there, we can immediately go in and try to prevent further spread of the disease.
Have we been doing do we have an effective program in our prisons which have high rates of HIV?
Prisons are another huge issue. There was a study recently of prisoners in Maryland where they did just tested people in prison and found that 7% of the people in prison had HIV and did not know it. And again, this is a unfortunately an area where we need to very much increase our efforts to prevent the transmission of HIV and also to treat prisoners. And I think there is generally resistance to treating prisoners about for HIV, for mental health problems, et cetera.
These are serious issues, but then you get into the weird stuff. In 2008, an HIV-positive man in Dallas was sentenced to 35 years in prison for spitting on a police officer. Although he wasn't convicted under an HIV-specific law, the jury in the case found his saliva to be a deadly weapon. Now, first of all, I'm not sure that it is.
Yes, that's correct. I don't think it is. Again, you have hysteria. You have a lot of misunderstanding. I don't know the circumstances of that case. I don't know the ethnicity of the person who was convicted. I don't know.
You're suggesting that race often plays a role.
Yes, exactly.
In these decisions.
Right. So I can only imagine.
I can only imagine about another case. An HIV-positive man in Detroit was charged with bioterrorism after he hit his neighbor's lip. The judge eventually dismissed that case.
Yes. So again, people are going to look for excuses to use HIV as a divide, as a way to separate us from them.
But things have gotten a lot better, haven't they? I remember we had a show with a judge and a lawyer. The judge in New York State had issued a directive that allowed bailiffs to wear gloves and hold HIV-positive prisoners at a distance. The lawyer was claiming that prejudiced juries. We put the judge and the lawyer together here on the show, and the judge actually changed his directive. But I suspect that that was a unique situation. There were probably similar situations all over the country.
Yes, there's still a lot of fear. And I think part of that is because HIV is spread through sex. It's high among as an incidence among gay men. It's high among injecting drug users. It's high among people of color. And there is a lot of people who fear each of those groups or cumulatively. And HIV is a way to justify or rationalize their fear and prejudice.
On the other hand, isn't it hard to transmit? I mean, you could kiss somebody with AIDS and not get the disease.
Correct. It's thought that kissing is not a way to transmit the disease, and the major way to get it through intercourse of one sort or the other can easily be prevented through condoms.
Aren't rates of infection rising among young gay men?
Yes. So
is this a matter of the message not getting out, even though I thought the message had gotten out?
Well, the message needs to keep getting out. And again, part of the difficulty is that sex is a deeply biologically rooted, driven activity. And unfortunately, when people start to take recreational drugs, they lose the ability to think forward as much as they should. That's a problem. And unfortunately, I think knowing someone with AIDS, seeing how horrible someone can look if they develop serious symptoms, can in fact motivate people to protect themselves more. So it's sort of out of sight, out of mind. If I don't know anyone with HIV, if the drugs, the medications help people look, quote, healthy, normal, unquote, then I don't need to think about it. I don't think about it, and I expose myself more.
A listener wonders about the implications of the recent closing of St. Vincent, since it was a major treater of the HIV population in New York.
Yes, that's very unfortunate. That, of course, is part of larger trends of, given the recession, et cetera, and changes in healthcare, hospitals downsizing, St. Vincent's had done a fabulous job for many years really serving its local community. I think that was an unfortunate decision.
Another listener asks, will HIV show up in a normal battery of blood tests?
That is the recommendation of the CDC. There is great resistance to that. A lot of doctors still feel, I don't want to be bothered. What am I going to do if the person tests positive? It's still scary to a lot of people, and there's still controversy. But particularly in certain areas, in the Bronx, for instance, the city has made an attempt to routinize testing.
Now, why would a doctor say that? Wouldn't a doctor be concerned about the fact that his patient was HIV positive?
Let's say a patient comes in the emergency room. I run the test now. I may not get the test for a while. There are shorter tests. Will I be responsible for making sure that the patient needs to get treatment? It involves talking about sexuality, which a lot of doctors are very hesitant to do. Involves counseling the person on protecting their partners. And a lot of people, doctors fear, quote, I don't want to get into that.
Dr. Robert Klitzman is director of the Masters of Bioethics Program at Columbia University and also director of the Ethics and Policy Corps of the HIV Center at Columbia. He is the author of numerous books, including Mortal Secrets, Truth and Lies in the Age of AIDS. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you very much. It's my pleasure.